Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We have three very interesting topics this week, starting with crime victim organization founder Alexis Moore, who talks about the dangers of cyber stalking and cyber bullying. She has lots of great advice about how to keep your kids safe online. We then lighten things up with our pop culture expert Eve Thomas, talking about all things Halloween, including the best costumes for 2012. After that, we chat with the author of Pink Ribbons, Inc., Dr. Samantha King. She explains where your donation dollars are really going regarding breast cancer awareness.
Capture your need for sound.
Online safety is just one of the major issues facing parents these days. With the recent tragic suicide of Amanda Todd in Canada, more and more young people seem to be coming forward with their stories of being cyberbullied. But how can parents safeguard their children against cyberbullying and cyberstalkers? Alexis Moore is the creator and founder of Crime Victim Organization and Advocate Network. This is the world's first online public safety virtual network, which unites crime victim agencies, law enforcement, and prosecutors from around the world, connecting resources and experts all in one virtual community. Alexis is also the president of Survivors in Action, a nonprofit crime victim organization. Having survived her own personal ordeal as a victim of stalking, Alexis makes it a priority to be a catalyst for change. Alexis Moore joins us to talk about what parents can do to protect their children against cyber stalking and cyberbullying. Alexis, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks for having me. This is such an important topic. I'm happy to be here to talk about it.
Alexis, I guess the first question I would have is if there is a big difference between cyberbullying and cyberstalking.
You know, there really isn't. And ironically, cyberstalking is all-encompassing, and it does encompass cyberbullying because the intent of the perpetrator is really how it defines the crime, and that's to harass, annoy, humiliate, torture the victim. And regardless of how it's put, cyberbullying just tends to impact children, and cyberstalking impacts adults and children and encompasses cyberbullying. And the tragic thing about words and play on words is oftentimes someone hears the word cyberbullying and they don't think it sounds as horrific as stalking or cyberstalking. So it's my job as an expert and an advocate for victims to make sure that folks realize that cyberbullying is just as horrible as cyberstalking, and they're actually very similar because the intent of the perpetrator is the same. So regardless what we call it or how we spell it, it's something that we all need to pay close attention to and ensure that victims have the tools they need to overcome.
Can you explain to us what would qualify as cyberstalking? Because I think some people, you know, it might be happening to them and they're not sure that this is actually what's going on.
Sure. Cyberstalking is any use of technology with the intent to harass, manipulate, intimidate, or control the victim. And it can be any piece of technology utilized. So it can be anything from a run-of-the-mill fax machine to now social media, Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, blogs, websites. Any use of technology with a purpose, intention only, not for any financial gain, but rather to torment the victim, harass them, annoy them, humiliate them, stalk them using technology. So that's the key, is just we're introducing technology into the mix. And it's been going on for a decade, maybe longer, but just recently with all of the news media and the changes globally to legislation, we're finally getting around to recognizing that cyberstalking is just as serious as stalking, and cyberbullying and cyberstalking both need to be addressed and victims need support.
What can people do if they are a victim of cyberstalking? How can they handle and protect themselves?
The first steps are start documenting immediately. Evidence is like anything, it becomes stale and it can disappear quickly, especially with the use of technology. So my advice as a survivor of cyberstalking as well as an advocate for victims and working thousands of cases, I have to say immediately, as horrible as it may be, get that evidence secure. And what I mean by get the evidence is start printing those web pages, taking screenshots, saving those emails, those text messages. And if you're not sure how to do any of this, consult with folks. Survivorsinaction.org. We're a national nonprofit crime victim agency that is here in the United States, but we do provide support to victims in Canada and anywhere around the world. So if you're in a position where you're just, wow, I don't know what to do or I feel overwhelmed, at least know that you need to immediately start collecting evidence and start documenting all of the incidents. And if you feel overwhelmed, start looking for help. And the help can come from an agency like Survivors in Action, or it can come from a neighbor, a family friend, a coworker. The key is just to start collecting that evidence and to start recording those incidents right away so that we can ensure that we get this activity acknowledged by law enforcement and that you get the help you need.
What can parents actually do, you know, to help their children from being a victim of, you know, cyberbullying and potentially cyberstalking?
Well, you know, the key is to remember that we cannot stop anyone permanently or anything permanently. So as hard as we work as a community to protect children online, it's still going to happen. So what we first have to do is just make our children aware that it exists and talk about it. As I say, communication is number one. So talking to kids about bullying and cyberstalking, using stories in the media like Amanda Todd and others as ways to introduce conversation is going to be key. Because, unfortunately, today, a parent's knee-jerk reaction is to say, well, I'm just not going to allow my child online, or I'm going to take him off Facebook, or I'm just not going to allow him to have access to anything. And that's a tragedy, because children need these tools to be able to function in society later in life, especially even today. They need the computer to do research for school projects and to complete assignments. So I hate to see that happen, where parents completely pull the plug on technology. So starting with communicating with them is vital. Just bring the subject up. My book, A Parent's Guide to Cyberstalking and Cyberbullying, Simple Ways to Protect Your Children, as easy as 1, 2, 3. You can get that book, put it on the coffee table, and use it as a starting point for conversation and find out from your kids and their friends if they're being bullied or cyberbullied or if they know these things are happening. And that's the most important thing to do.
Joining us on the show is Alexis Moore, author of A Parent's Guide to Cyberstalking and Cyberbullying. You can learn more about her at alexismoore.com. Is there any way to determine if you, your family, or your children are at a high risk of being a victim of cyberbullying or cyberstalking?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and one way to really analyze this is to look at it from an objective point of view. If you know that your child is visible online and that they're interacting with strangers, whether it be on social media sites or interacting on gaming sites or any technology without really identifying who they're interacting with, that's a high risk. And those are things that we tend to look out for and to encourage parents to discuss with their kids that they are potentially putting themselves in harm's way. And they really don't know if they're communicating with strangers who they are. It could be an adult. It could be a teen. It could be really who they say they are or not. So knowing who is in your social network and your technological network is very important. And that's something that we need to be considering right away if your child, for example, is involved in youth groups or online doing, participating in discussions or using the internet and interacting with folks they really don't know personally. This is a danger, and it's something that puts them at risk and should be discussed. And a lot of this has to do with just open communication, and I'm going to say it again, speak out. Speaking out about cyberbullying, talking about it, getting the kids to talk about it at any age, getting educators and officials to talk about it. Speaking out and telling the victims also to speak out and be brave and discuss if they are being victimized is going to be key to helping to harness this issue and start moving victims away from thinking that they're hopeless or helpless or that they have to turn to suicide or any other tragic event taking place. We want to stop that, and how we can do that is encouraging them to speak out and to be brave and to continue to speak out until they get help and support.
What's your position on kids and social media, you know, and how this could obviously impact them being cyberbullied? You know, do you think there's a certain age that kids should be before they get a Facebook or a Twitter account?
You know, it's going to vary on the maturity of the child and how much parental control is involved. Youngsters as young as 6, 7 years old have access to the internet and are out there using it and involved with social media. So what we have to think about as a community and parents and educators, caregivers, is where is my child developmentally wise? You know, are they capable of using good judgment online, or do we need to monitor their activities? When is a good age? You know, it's going to depend on the child's maturity and the parent's ability to see the potential warning signs and to be active in their child's online experience. You know, unfortunately, we are handing kids technology pretty young, and there's those out there that have iPhones and access to technology that I wouldn't have had access to at all because it didn't even exist when we were kids. So as parents, out there listening to the show and thinking about this, it really is going to be a very subjective case-by-case, child-by-child, when and if you give them access, and what type of access and how you put the limitations and how you control it is up to the parent, and they need to be thinking of these things. And it's sometimes you don't even think about it because you see their friends or they're doing it at school or it seems like it's safe enough because no one in the family has had any issue or it hasn't happened at our school kind of a thing. And so it's really important, though, with this recent news story with Amanda Todd and her case as well as the many, many others, that we take a step back and we start thinking about what things we have done already and what we can do to protect our kids and what safeguards we can put in place to ensure their safety online.
The fact that you are someone who is an advocate for, or against, rather, cyberstalking and cyberbullying, do you find in your work experience that it's hard for you to get some people to take cyberbullying seriously? Like, I feel that there's still an attitude out there, although I feel it is getting better, that some people think, oh, it's really not that bad.
Exactly. It is troubling, to say the very least. Cyberbullying, cyberstalking, it's a very difficult situation to present to the public as being a threat or any real danger, especially today when acts of violence are rampant across the world and we're seeing so many violent acts being perpetrated everywhere. People tend not to think that technology is violent or technology can lead to death. And that's why I'm here to say that it is violent. It can lead to homicide, suicide, and that's the whole picture that we're trying to get our policymakers, parents, educators, and our entire global community aware of, that cyberbullying, cyberstalking is just as heinous as any other crime, and it needs to be taken seriously. But again, because of our difficult times and seeing the violence that we do, often you just don't think of tech being a real threat and take it seriously as it needs to be taken. So it is difficult, to answer your question, to find victims' help. And tragically, victim resources and educators and caregivers and civic groups, it's up to all of us to get together and unite and find ways to evolve so that we can serve and protect this community of individuals when they reach out for help. And I think that's been the biggest hurdle so far in the last decade, is getting folks to realize that we've got to evolve existing resources and make sure that we include the cyberstalking, bullying, and cyberbullying community, so that when folks do realize they are being bullied or cyberbullied or cyberstalked, that they have a resource to turn to for help. Because now we're promoting so much awareness, but we're really not offering any support. There is no place for these folks who realize they're being bullied, cyberbullied. They just don't know where to go, whether it be a parent or an educator. They just don't know what to do because it's very difficult to find help. So that's something that I'm working on very diligently.
Now, Alexis, you come from a place of understanding, because if I understand things correctly, you yourself were a victim of stalking. Is that why you decided to get involved in this, to help other people from what you've experienced?
Yes, it is. In 2004, I began a horrible cyberstalking experience where technology was used to harass, manipulate, and literally torture me financially as well as jeopardize my personal safety. And I reached out for help and was called crazy and told that, you know, by law enforcement and officials that they'd never heard of such a thing and how could technology be used to stalk. And at that particular time, I had a choice. You know, I could either stand idle and hope that someone else would take the reins and get the cyberstalking awareness started, or I could do it myself. And I just decided it was time to take action and do what I could. I have my experience stems from being an investigator, locating people and assets using technology and all of that in my 9-to-5 life. So I was very fortunate that I understood a lot about technology. However, I just never realized that cyberstalking and the potential was there while working in the industry. And it just so happened that after being victimized, it just changed my life, but it changed it for the positive. The book stems, the Parent's Guide to Cyberstalking and Cyberbullying is one of a personal nature. I happen to have utilized a web counter, and that tracks incoming and outgoing web traffic and a lot of keywords and that type of thing on my various websites for risk management and also for marketing purposes. And I kept seeing the words Alexis more suicide, Alexis more bully, and it was troubling and it really shook me up. And I ended up learning that an Alabama teen had committed suicide named Alexis Moore, of all things. And I felt that that was a message to me. And doing some research, I discovered there were not any parents' guides or information on cyberbullying or cyberstalking. And I decided at that point that I had done a lot of work with adults and families, and I had not yet come full circle and done a parent's guide or participated in that genre yet. So that's what led to the book. And 100% of the proceeds are being donated to support victims and to assist victims of bullying and cyberbullying. So I'm very happy to be able to contribute, but I wish it wasn't for those very reasons.
Now, something I wanted to touch upon as well, because it's very important, I think, to help, you know, victims get through this. What are some of, I guess, the biggest obstacles that cyberstalking victims need to overcome so that they can come out the other side and lead, you know, healthy and productive lives?
Well, feeling isolated is the number one. Because it's a technological attack, it happens without leaving any broken bones or bruises for anyone else to see. So a lot of times a victim feels isolated, and because they don't have that physical injury to report or to say to a doctor or teacher or to even their parent, hey, I am hurt, that puts a very big boundary in place of victims being able to overcome. And then the response, unfortunately, because there really is no place for a victim to turn to for help, it becomes very difficult. And what I mean by that is there is not yet an official cyberbully, cyberstalk resource in every place where a victim or a caregiver or an educator can refer or go to for help and get direct support. There's lots of foundations that offer literature and are legislatively active, but finding that direct help is very, very difficult. So we have to be creative and utilize what is existing and what we do have. And in the schools, there's peer counselors, there's child psychologists, and there's you know, all kinds of advocates and such with crime victim agencies. So what we're trying to do is get these groups to understand that we have a role in this, and we can be sure that victims do not feel isolated and they do have places to turn for direct support, but it's going to require participation by these groups. So civic groups and churches, schools, officials, you name it, all of us, crime victim agencies, charities, we're going to have to evolve and ensure that this particular group of folks has a place to turn to for help, so that these victims that are isolated now do have a place to turn where people will understand and give them the support and the tools they need to overcome.
Alexis, before I let you go, what would be your biggest piece of advice to someone who is undergoing, you know, cyberbullying or cyberstalking? Because, again, I think it's important that they know where to head to first.
Be brave and speak out. If we can just remember those four words, if you're a victim or if you know of someone who may be a victim of cyberbullying or cyberstalking, the first thing you need to say is be brave and speak out. Because unless you speak out, and you may have to speak out many times, and that's why I'm saying as a victim survivor of cyberstalking that it's going to require a lot of work and perhaps it's going to be very difficult. But be brave and speak out so you can overcome, so we can get you those tools and so that we can get you the help you need so you're not isolated and alone. Because obviously there are many out there right now who may be listening, even parents right now listening, who may not know what to do. And parents, this applies to you as well. Be brave and speak out. Reach out for help, because we can't help you unless we have you reach out and communicate with us.
Fantastic. Alexis, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Alexis Moore, again, author of A Parent's Guide to Cyberstalking and Cyberbullying. Make sure to check out her website, alexismoore.com.
Capture your need for sound.
For some people, Halloween is nothing but just another day on the calendar. For others, it is treated like a national holiday. To give us an idea just how prolific Halloween actually is and what's happening this year is Associate Editor of SpaFacts Luxury Brands and Kelly Alexander Show pop culture expert, Eve Thomas. Eve, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
Halloween, you know, is one of those days that has obviously turned out to be quite commercial in terms of decorations and all that sort of stuff. Do you actually foresee families spending more money this year on lavish decorations or maybe cutting back?
It looks like they are going to be spending as much as they do every year, which is around $7 billion in the United States alone. It's actually less than Mother's Day, less than Father's Day, less than Christmas, obviously, but that's still a big chunk of change.
That is a big chunk of change. I had no idea that people spend that much. But it's funny because this morning I went out for a run around the hood, a little jog, and I just happened to look up at this one area I was running through, and this house had gone insane. Like, they had lost their mind. Like everything, like there was must have been like 15 pumpkins on the lawn, witches that they'd made. Like it was just insane.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's a bit like Christmas too. You get the Halloween creep where I saw, you know, costume stores and candy out in probably early September.
Yes, that's also creepy that they go out so early. And I've already seen Christmas stuff, which we'll leave alone for now. So you said 7 billion in the U.S. alone.
Mm-hmm. And I think about a third of that is on candy.
Wow. Okay. Now, can you actually give us some predictions on what we're going to be seeing this Halloween in terms of costumes for kids?
I definitely can, because I've been snooping in costume shops. I've been checking out online, seeing what's sold out. So I have a pretty good gauge. For children specifically, the new trends are mostly for girls, because there's that new Disney princess movie, Brave.
Okay.
So, well, girls are always, you know, the Disney princesses are always really big, but now that there's a new one, you can expect to see sort of red wigs or redhead girls very happy to be princesses. And also they just released, I think, Cinderella on Blu-ray, so you can expect a few of those. And the other thing, it's one of those trends that is so huge, but unless you have a little girl or unless you have a niece, you probably have never even heard of it. It's called Monster High. It started as dolls, basically kind of like Barbie meets old movie monsters. They're these sort of fashionable teenage girls who are also part monster. So the main character is called Frankie Stein. And then there's Laguna Blue, who's the daughter of a sea monster. And so they start as dolls, and now there's a TV show, there's a cartoon, there's like music videos, and I have a niece who reads these, and they are obsessed with them. But they're perfect for Halloween, so you can expect some sort of very fashionable, you know, mummies and Frankenstein's monsters.
Okay. I had a question with regards to, I guess, boys and some of their things. Like for example, my nephew the other day, he wanted me to see what he was going to wear, and I was surprised because it was like a throwback. And I guess that's my question, is there lots of throwbacks going on? Because all of a sudden he came bounding down the stairs. Now he's only six. He literally turned six like a week ago, and he came bounding down the stairs as Luke Skywalker.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, you have to realize, it's like with the Disney princesses. If it's the first time they've seen it and it's a classic, you know, it's the first time he's seen Star Wars, he's going to be just as enamored of it as, you know, little boys were when it originally came out. Same thing with a lot of the superheroes. They may see the first Batman. They may see, well, they probably shouldn't see the most recent Batman, but they may have seen, you know, the more modern cartoons, and those sort of classics never go out of style.
Okay, fantastic. Now, when it comes to the older set, meaning adults, but I also wanted to ask you about teenagers, because I know teenagers are a little strange. Like,
yeah,
sometimes they want to get involved, and then there's the whole contingent of, this is not cool.
Right.
So, yes.
Yeah.
So where's your stance on that?
It's tough, right? Because unless, you know, oh God, there's nothing worse than the teenager who comes to your door to trick or treat and is wearing, you know, a hoodie.
Yeah.
Then.
And they're like, I'm Eminem.
They'll give you a trick. I think you have to say, if they really want the candy, just give it to them. It's probably, it would probably be less shameful if they were wearing a full outfit. You know, for trends for them, it really depends if they're younger teenagers or older teenagers.
Yeah.
I think for younger, definitely Hunger Games is big.
Oh, okay.
You'll still see some Harry Potters running around, but I think you're going to see a lot of Katnisses and people with bows and arrows, especially since the actual costume's quite, you know, flattering. You could basically just wear a black top and pants and then just have sort of your weapon. You know, it's not too uglifying.
When did you stop dressing up? And I mean, like, as a teenager, because usually, like, I feel there's a time, like, I stopped dressing up at 13. I think 13 was my last year of sort of doing it. And then I picked up again at like 20 for, you know, parties or whatever.
Well, I think probably right around there. I think in the last year, you know, I still eat a lot of candy. And I definitely was going for candy, but I think the last year I must have been about 13 or 14, and my friends and I went, and we were kind of like, okay, this is it. But it's funny, because actually the National Retail Federation in the United States says that 89% of 18 to 24-year-olds are going to dress up, so I feel like it may have gotten bigger that this older, but not too old, demographic has really embraced Halloween.
Because, that's awesome.
You know, you think about it, you know, a holiday for kids.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's great, especially if you have just a fun time with it. I guess my problem is I've seen a few too many 16-year-old boys, you know, butting over little 9-year-olds to get to candy. And it's like, you know what, buddy, just go to Walmart yourself and buy the $2 candy.
I know. Get a paper round. And tomorrow, I promise you, all the candy will be half off.
But yes.
Who knows?
Yeah, it's just kind of weird. So I kind of think that teenagers should take a break from it, and I don't want to cancel them out. Like I said, if it's a Halloween party, by all means, like, do what you need to do, like, have a great time. But I guess my thoughts are, please just don't bowl over the 6, 7, 8-year-olds that are trying to do what they need to do.
Yeah, just don't. And I think I see trick-or-treating going on so early now that it doesn't even register for a lot of teenagers. You know, it's people are blowing out their pumpkins at like 7 o'clock. So I think you're right, though. A party for 13 to 16 year olds is probably the best place to put them.
And I'm glad you brought up the blowing out the pumpkins thing, because I wanted to ask you your opinion on that. When do you think it's acceptable to shut her down?
When the candy's out.
Oh yeah, so that's because I know some people buy, you know, 10 million pounds of this stuff, and so there really is no shortage.
Oh God, I did not come from that family. I think if there's more than a 20-minute gap between trick-or-treaters, I think you're allowed to buy.
Okay. Because I notice it's different in different neighborhoods, but the one thing that I have noticed is that, you know, it has in the last, I would say, I don't know, I'm going to say 5 or 6 years, it might be a little bit more than that, but I've noticed that it has started so early. Like, kids are going out at 4 and 4:30, and I get it if they're little, but to me, I'm like, don't you want to wait a little bit till it's dark?
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. I wonder if it's taking sort of the scare out of Halloween.
Yeah, like, I remember when I was a kid, like, we did not go out until it was dark. Mm-hmm. Like, we just didn't. Like, it just didn't happen. And now I see these munchkins out. I get it if you're, like, 4 or 3 and the parents are taking you around. But if you're a little bit older, like, you're not going to be going to bed at 6:30. So why can't you stay out till 7:30? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think one night a year, they should just let them go out late. And even then, you know, if they're sleepy, let them do 5 houses and then go home.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't know the difference.
You know, I have actually have a friend that comes on the show here, our almost mother of the year, Casey Savage, and she actually has, I guess, tricked her kids, her 3 boys, into believing that they only can keep 5 pieces of candy. So she has them trained. Like, they go out and get maybe, you know, 25 pieces or whatever it is, but they have to hand over all of it except for 5.
Oh, wow. And then what does she do with the rest?
I think she gets rid of it. Yeah.
Okay.
She gets rid of it, and she's like, I just don't want them having all that sugar. And it's not that she never lets them have a treat, but mm-hmm. she's like, you know what, 5 is more than enough. And I was like, wow, like, I can't even imagine. I used to remember having my little pumpkin bowl was, like, full, and I was like, woo, like, I'd have it for a month.
Oh, the little pumpkin bowl, I forgot about that.
Yes, it's good. Anyways, go on, what did you have?
I had a pillowcase.
Cool. Good for you. That's good. I saw a lot of people with those too. Joining us on the show is our pop culture expert, Eve Thomas, who has an awesome blog. You need to check out thegreatergoods.org. You can also follow her on Twitter at Eve Loves Luxury. Now, Eve, you know, I've noticed in the past couple of years a lot of sexy costumes, quote unquote. You know, is that trend still big this year?
Yes, it couldn't be any bigger. I think we've actually reached some sort of saturation point, because it's like every year, you know, originally it was kind of sexy French maid, sexy cat, the ubiquitous sexy cat. And even, you know, there are certain costumes. I think this year you might see some 50 Shades of Grey inspired things, people with neckties. But it's not the sexy outfits. It's the sexifying of outfits that has really exploded. And it's borderline parody now. I think they're specifically making some of these costumes just for the laughs, and just so people will forward them to each other online. Like, I had to check with a lot of the ones I found that they were real, that you could buy them, because it seemed like they were from a satirical site, but you could. I think the most ridiculous one I saw, you know, the most ridiculous one I've ever seen in my life, I think, was sexy Bert and Ernie costumes.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, you have to Google this, because they're not offensive. They're like short shorts and overalls with sort of striped crop tops, and then you wear the Bert or Ernie mask sort of on top of your head like a hat, so you don't have to ruin your makeup, I guess. But it is just, I don't know.
That is bizarre.
They also had, yeah. They also had sexy Big Bird, Cookie Monster, and Oscar the Grouch costumes.
I don't know if I want to know about that. Like, that is wrecking my childhood a little.
I know. It's very weird. It's very specific. And they had, Winnie the Pooh, but they actually, I think they call it something like Sexy Golden Bear because, you know, for some reason, no one wanted to license out a treasured children's icon for a costume made of latex and fun fur.
Wow.
I just can't think of the motivation behind them. You know,
yeah, me neither. I said me neither. Yeah, I find that really, like, bizarre. Like especially if it's, you know, someone who, you know, watched these shows as a kid. Like, I don't understand why all of a sudden you'd want to be, like, Sexy Bert. Like, Bert to me is like Bert and Ernie, and I was five, and that's the way it is.
It can only be... It just sends so many weird mixed messages. I only hope that people aren't getting these to, you know, give out candy to neighborhood kids.
Yes.
Because I can't even imagine the message. Oh. I mean, the thing is, I have no problem with people who want to dress sexy for Halloween. That's totally fine. That's mm-hmm. the night to do it. Everyone, it's an excuse. But I say, you know, be a vampire or be Marie Antoinette or be an NFL cheerleader. Don't drag children.
Yeah, like it almost feels like it's like some sort of weird fetish.
Yeah.
You know, like some cartoony fetish? Like, I don't know. It's very odd.
But, hate to think of the implications, but I like to believe that it really is just some sort of industry joke where they are just, whoever is responsible for designing these costumes is just trying to think of what they can make that's so neutral or so unsexy, what they can try and make sexy for women, and they just go for it.
Wow. Now, I have to ask you about this because this sort of came to mind, and it was shocking to me, but it's probably because even though I am a farm kid, I do not own a personal pet right now in my own house. But what do you, you know, where do you draw the line with dressing up animals as and pets?
It's very tough. I mean, especially with the internet now, because I guess people would dress up their animals occasionally before, but now knowing that you can sort of share these embarrassing photos with everyone, I think, is encouraging people. I did, in quite a few costume shops, I did see a lot of dog costumes, and in the pet stores, I saw a lot of animal costumes. I also found a really staggering number. I don't know how reliable this is, but it said that Americans plan on spending about over $300 million on costumes for their pets.
That is insane.
It's, you know, I guess it's a drop in the bucket in $7 billion, but it's still pretty staggering. I mean, they might not all be for Halloween, of course, you understand.
Right.
Some of them could be for Christmas or Valentine's.
Well, I guess I should sort of think back for a second, because my sister had a dog for a long time. He was a black lab, very cute, and she would always put on a Santa hat for Christmas, and it was funny. So I suppose, you know, dressing up with maybe a little vampire hat for them might be funny, or a pumpkin thing.
Well, what is funny, though, is that I didn't think, you know, I was like, okay, looking into human trends, and I thought, okay, animal costumes aren't going to have trends, but apparently they kind of do. I was looking at this blog called the Dog Vacay blog, and they said the top trends for dogs included, they're a lot more elaborate than they used to be, you know, a little hat or bandana. There's this great one I've seen in person, which is, it makes the dog look like it's being eaten by a crocodile. So it's walking around, and then, of course, its back legs are sort of covered by the front legs of the crocodile, and the mouth is around them. And there's also another really great one that's, it looks like your dog is being ridden by, like, a little cowboy or a little person on top, like they've got a little saddle.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty cute. And doggy superheroes as well. Superheroes are always big, and including for pets.
Wow. Well, that's great. I think that is kind of funny, especially the crocodile thing. That makes me laugh. And I wanted to touch base on, you know, because you've been doing all of this research, what is the strangest or weirdest costume overall that you've come across this year?
You know, I was at Comic-Con not too long ago, and I definitely got a taste for just the weirdest, you know, the weirdest, best costumes. I've seen some from parties already people have had, but I think the weirdest human one I've seen, it was online, but it was sexy Osama bin Laden.
Are you serious?
Yes, 100%. And again, it feels like satire, but I think not just, it wasn't just ridiculous, it wasn't just offensive, but it's not even topical anymore.
Yeah.
So it's just a bad idea for so many reasons. But the other funny thing that I just learned about, and it's not Halloween specific, but it's still the weirdest costume idea ever. It's not for humans, and it's not even for pets. It's for your, it's called My Room Bud, and it's a costume for your Roomba, which is, those are those circular vacuum cleaners that roll around the room and they suck up dust. So this company, they offer slip covers that look like a tiger or a cow or a ladybug. And in their words, if you don't dress up your Roomba, it's just a naked vacuum. And
wow.
Yeah, the most ridiculous thing I've seen. Although I looked into it and the company is actually owned. I was started by a group of school kids and sort of as a project. So, you know, it's not. It's ridiculous, but it's cute.
Okay, that's cool. Now, you and I talked a couple of years ago when you came on around Halloween about scary movies and all that sort of good stuff. And so I feel like it would be remiss of me if I didn't ask you at least one Halloween scary movie question. So that would be, what is your, you know, favorite scary movie of all time around Halloween?
Around Halloween, I love scary movies, so I watch them all the time. But I have to say, the classic, you know, it's kind of like watching White Christmas around Christmas, mm-hmm. is watching The Shining.
Oh, okay.
So Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. It's beautiful, it's cinematic, but it's also quite terrifying. And not just that, Stephen King has written a sequel. People might not know that, and that should be coming out soon. So it should be really interesting to read that right after rewatching the movie.
Fantastic. And for people who don't sort of pay attention to this sort of, I guess, area of entertainment, do they really release a lot of scary movies around Halloween, or is it spread out throughout the year regardless?
There are definitely quite a few right now. I think sometimes they try and get the kind of lesser scary movies in at the same time. But there's quite a few from the people who did the Paranormal Activity movies.
Right.
And those, I haven't read the reviews yet, but yeah, they know people, especially, actually, that's something that teenagers can do. Instead of bugging people trick-or-treating, they can all just go bug people at the movie theater instead of a scary movie.
That's a good plan. Well, Eve, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
That's Eve Thomas, our pop culture expert. Again, make sure to check out her blog, thegreatergoods.org, and also follow her on Twitter, @EveLovesLuxury.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
With October being Breast Cancer Awareness Month, many people can be seen wearing the pink ribbon and donating to the cause. But do you know where your money is really going? On the show today, we talked to Dr. Samantha King, the author of Pink Ribbons, Inc., and we discussed the politics and philanthropy involved with the pink ribbon. Dr. Samantha King is Associate Professor at Queen's University in Women's Studies and Kinesiology. Samantha, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you very much.
When did you first become interested with the Pink Ribbon campaign?
It was in the late 1990s. I was living in the United States in graduate school, and I began to notice the profusion of pink ribbon products on the shelves and the growth of the fundraising walks and runs. So it's actually quite a long time ago. At the time, I didn't think that the public interest in the disease would last as long as it has, but it's actually only grown over that period since then.
When it comes to events, I guess, you know, such as the Run for the Cure, the Weekend to End Breast Cancer, and all of those sort of events, what, I guess, comes to mind? Like, what are your thoughts on all of these, you know, rah-rah-rah breast cancer events?
Well, the one thing, I guess, on the positive side of things that I found in my research is that they do provide a forum for people to come together. For some women, it might be the first time that they've been public about their diagnosis with breast cancer. They provide a form of temporary community, and they do raise some money, some more than others, and some of those events have very high overhead costs. Others are more efficient as fundraising tools. But one of the observations that I've also made is that they tend to be very optimistic to the point where there's almost no room for recognition that people still die of the disease, and in fact they die of the disease in the same, roughly the same numbers as they did before the pink ribbon industry really took hold. And there's not a lot of room for us to acknowledge that in the rah-rah climate that you referred to in your question.
What's your thoughts on the fact that, you know, these events,
mobilize, you know, thousands and thousands of men and women, you know, to get together and support each other for the cause. And then I guess the pervasive understanding is that, you know, not a lot of the money that's actually raised goes towards helping to find a cure. What's your thoughts on all of that?
Well, certainly they're not efficient fundraising vehicles. Most foundations use these big kinds of events to get their brand name out there, to get public recognition for their cause, not so much for their fundraising potential. Having said that, the Run for the Cure, certainly the Weekend to End Women's Cancers, they do raise substantial amounts of money, but the problem then becomes, you know, how is that money spent? What kinds of research does it fund? And what we find is that the research that is funded is really focused on screening and on treatment, on cure-oriented research. And these are forms of research that respond to breast cancer that's already in the body. So there's really a bias away from primary prevention and from trying to figure out what it is that causes breast cancer. We're really working at the back end of things with Band-Aid solutions. And that really needs to change if we're actually going to make a difference. If all this money that's being raised is actually going to make a difference, we have to have a massive shift in our research priorities.
Do you think a lot of people, you know, have the wool pulled over their eyes with whether it's the pink ribbon or other such ideas? Because I'm even, you know, I guess I want to compare this situation to maybe even someone watching television and seeing, you know, the poor children in Africa, and then, you know, they call up and donate, but they might not really be sure where their money's actually going.
Well, certainly there's, I think, across the realm of charitable giving, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of making people aware of what actually is an effective fundraising tool and of making large foundations accountable for how they spend our money. But for me, really, the bigger problem is that we tend to think that that giving money, that donating, is an effective way of bringing about social change. And it's, in fact, very limited. And as I always like to say, you know, big revolutions, change, social change doesn't generally come through fundraising and philanthropy. And so, and that's really a phenomenon of the last few decades, that more and more and more we've come to see active citizenship and effective citizenship in terms of donating money or buying stuff. And we really need to think about that a bit more critically.
What's your position on the fact that, you know, so many people have a very strong connection to whether it's the pink ribbon or, you know, wearing sort of the pink bracelets? For example, my mom is a breast cancer survivor, and when she was going through the treatment and all, and, you know, even sort of the scary part where we didn't really know what was happening, I found myself feeling comforted by wearing this pink bracelet. And, you know, I didn't even have the disease, but it was my mom. But then I would see other people who were living through it, and some of them just seemed to be very connected to that pink color, to that pink ribbon. It almost gave them strength. Like, is there a way that people need to sort of separate the two situations, and the fact that, you know, we need to be aware that it is a positive symbol, but, you know, maybe, like you said, not all of the resources are going where they should?
Well, certainly I think people have different experiences of pink ribbon culture, and for some people it does provide support and comfort and recognition. The problem is that within that culture there's very little room for people who don't identify with it positively. So in my research, I've been surprised actually by the numbers of women who said to me that they find it alienating, that it doesn't reflect their experience of the disease, that whether it's the femininity, whether it's the infantilization, whether it's the over-optimism, whether it's the commercialization, there are many different aspects of it that people have noted to me that they find problematic. And so what I would argue we need is just space for all different kinds of experiences within that culture.
When it comes to these events that, again, you know, raise money for breast cancer, or, you know, to end women's breast cancer, do you think that it's, you know, or that it would be surprising to a lot of people just how little money, you know, might be going to these causes? Like, is it the fact that it's getting lost in the hoopla of creating these, you know, everyone's wearing a t-shirt, everyone's got this, that, and something else going on, they've brought in this, that, and something else. So all of this costs money to make it this big grand affair, and then that's taking away money that could actually be going to research.
Absolutely. And most of the companies who do breast cancer marketing spend more on marketing the products with the pink ribbon, packaging them, researching them, advertising them, than they do donating to the cause. And I think that people probably aren't aware of that. Or do we stop and think whether we're really going to overcome a disease that's linked to consumer lifestyles by buying more stuff? These are all questions that we need to ask. And more than that, though, I would just say that I think people are surprised when I point out to them that nothing's really changed. Where basically women have the same treatment options they had 30 or 40 years ago before all this hoopla began. You know, chemotherapy, radiation, and treatment, the percentage of each may have changed a little bit, but basically they're in the same position they were back then, and there's lots of research coming out now about women who've been diagnosed a second time and how they're basically going through the same thing, perhaps with slightly more sensitive medical care in some cases. And I think that's what's shocking to people, that in spite of all the money that's been raised and all the awareness that's been derived, we're still back, stuck where we were pretty much at the beginning.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is author of Pink Ribbons, Inc., Dr. Samantha King. Dr. King, when you were doing all of your research for this, what shocked you the most, I guess, about the pink ribbon?
Oh, that's a good question. I think certainly I've been shocked by some of the corporate products that it's been attached to. You know, Kentucky Fried Chicken in the United States, oil drilling platforms in the tar sands here in Canada, that really toxic products could be sold in the name of fundraising for breast cancer, I think is pretty shocking. I also think just the disconnect between the overly optimistic culture of breast cancer and the reality underneath that is also something that surprised me, even as someone who went in with a critical eye to begin with.
What's your position on the fact that major league sports have now gotten involved in this? For example, the NFL and the CFL in Canada, Canadian Football League, National mm-hmm. Football League in the States. You know, October, you see all these big, you know, 6'5", 280-pound guys wearing pink along with their uniform. Do you think any of that is beneficial, or is it just, again, on the bandwagon?
It's marketing. You know, I mean, I don't know. Some people will say, well, even if it doesn't raise any money, and even if they're spending more money on their marketing and buying the pink gloves for the NFL players to wear, at least it's raising awareness. But the research shows very clearly that people are aware that breast cancer exists. They're aware that there are guidelines around mammography, however problematic those might be. And in fact, that women overestimate their risk of breast cancer and underestimate their risk of other diseases that are more likely to kill them. So for me, it's very hard to see anything positive in these kinds of campaigns.
And why do you think that, you know, so few people, you know or understand what's really behind the Pink Ribbon campaign? Is it, again, because everyone just gets caught up in the hoopla? And I almost want to compare it to, you know, back in the, I guess, the early 90s when everyone seemed to jump on the bandwagon with the AIDS ribbon.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly... I think there is a bit of a crowd mentality. I'm always surprised, though maybe I shouldn't be, when I ask retailers or corporate marketing executives why it is they picked breast cancer as their chosen cause. Often they can't answer that question.
Really?
They're just doing it, I think, because everybody else is doing it, which interestingly flies in the face of marketing know-how, which is usually that you try to distinguish your brand from those of other people. So breast cancer really flies in the face of that conventional thinking. But it's also that it does make us feel good. We feel like we're doing something, and that's very seductive. And it's a quick fix, and we like quick fixes. And it takes time and effort to do grassroots activism. And if you can just buy a product which benefits you and gives some money at the same time, then, you know, that seems like a good option to a lot of people, and understandably so.
What would you say to people, you know, that are out there now listening, in the fact that, like, how they should be careful to, I guess, support a cause that, where the money is really going to go to support that cause? Like, what would you say to someone who wants to be involved and not just on the surface?
Well, it's a hard question to answer in some ways for all people for all occasions. But I think that the main message that I like to convey is that we need to start asking different questions about what it means to make change, and to question whether simply giving money or raising money is an appropriate response, that there are lots of organizations out there doing really good activist work, educational work, policy work that is designed to make real and long-lasting change, not to benefit, quite frankly, large corporations and the status quo with breast cancer or a whole other host of diseases.
Dr. King, where can people actually get a copy of your book, Pink Ribbons, Inc.?
Well, they can get it online through directly from the publisher, the University of Minnesota Press, but also from all the other usual online retailers. And in many cases, local bookstores will also have it in stock.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it today.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Samantha King, author of Pink Ribbons, Inc. Again, you can get her book at online retailers like Amazon.com, and also check out the NFB documentary Pink Ribbons, Inc.
Bring on the remix.
That's Katy Perry with Wide Awake, the Cosmic Dawn radio edit on The Kelly Alexander Show. Well, a big thank you going out to my guests this week, Alexis Moore, Eve Thomas, as well as Dr. Samantha King. I want to leave you with your inspirational quote of the week, this time from Stephen Redhead. Create your own miracles. Don't just wait for miracles to happen. Infinite possibilities exist by keeping focus on what you really want. Now, next week on the show, we chat with career counselor Sharon Armstrong about how to handle as well as protect yourself during job interviews. Companies are now asking more and more personal questions, and you need to be armed with the right information so that you don't get taken advantage of. Don't forget to check us out on Twitter, K Alexander Show, as well as on Facebook, The Kelly Alexander Show, and our YouTube channel, youtube.com/Kelly Alexander Show. All of our celebrity interviews have now been posted online. If you have any comments or questions, very simple, Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.